Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
What did you work on yesterday? What were you doing?
It was kind of fun. We did a, it was a promo for all the NBA Live TV shows.
Yeah.
With all their hosts, you know, Isaiah Thomas.
Okay. Was C. Barkley in the house?
No.
You've worked with them though, right?
Charles
Barkley?
Oh, yeah. Those guys do the NBA on TNT.
Oh, okay. So this is different.
Yeah. Which is funny because the studio is right next to it, but I was remarking that I don't think I've ever shot in there because the NBA TV is so busy. They are always live in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did promos for all their shows. It was fun.
Nice. And
the director over there, Kyle Wells, was a lot of fun to work with. And, you know, it was a fun day.
Well, what are you doing tonight? Happy Halloween. It's Halloween, everybody.
I know.
Like, this is almost in real time. That's how down to the wire I'm playing things these days.
Halloween is such a strange event. You know, it's I guess when I was a kid, I just, you know, Halloween happened when we went door to door. But now it's like, you know, I was driving through Atlanta last weekend. I saw kids out in Morningside and
trick-or-treating?
Yeah, I guess they did it the weekend before.
What?
Because
the fuck is going on in Morningside?
The weekend after would be past the 31st.
Yeah. Oh, so they wanted to do it on a weekend?
Yeah, but not after actual Halloween, I guess.
Well, no, because trick-or-treating in November is weird. But the whole that's all weird because my neighborhood is very strict about Halloween night.
You're strict in your satanic observances of All Hallows Eve.
Samhain, come down.
We can only sacrifice the newborn as the moon waxeth on the 31st.
It is, there's always someone on the neighborhood Facebook page who's like, hey, why don't we push it to Friday this year? And everyone just piles on. And this year, as you know, it's been raining nonstop. And they were calling, I think it's going to clear up just in time, but they were calling for thunderstorms and people were dumb enough to say, hey, do we really have to trick or treat in the rain? And then people started piling on about kids being soft. And I was going like, well, I don't want to walk around in the rain either.
Yeah.
So I'm soft. Soft, like baby shit.
As an older American, I cannot get into this piling on the millennials. I have a lot of sympathy for our
younger brethren?
Our younger brethren, yeah. I remember being younger. It's not easy. I would not go back to my 20s for anything. That was a hard time in life.
Really?
I mean, I had fun, but there's so much pressure. You feel like you should be farther ahead in your career.
Well,
and, you know, it's.
I think what we all want is to go back and be in our whatever age we want to be with the current either wisdom or status or both.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, I would love to be where I am in life now at 26.
Yes.
That'd be fucking fantastic.
As I like to say, I just like to be skinny again. I'll be just as dumb as I was, but could I just be skinny again for a minute?
I thought I was fat back then. I look at those old pictures and I'm like, yeah, boy, you don't know fat. What? You should go trick-or-treating with us tonight. What are you guys doing? Anything?
She's working again tonight. It's...
Well, if you want to come in, I mean, there are worse things to do than walk around the neighborhood with Ruby and with a beer in your hand.
What's she dressed as?
What?
She's dressed as a beer.
Yeah, she's a beer can. She's a Duff beer. No, we fought the princess thing successfully for 4 years in our house. But this year she finally wants to be Sophia the princess, Sophia the First. It's a cartoon.
Well, that's not a bad one because she was adopted. And...
It's fine. Oh, was Sophia adopted?
Yeah.
See, I don't even know this.
I know this because of Lily.
Oh, well, that helps then because, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's a good – if she's gonna go for a princess, let her go for one that's, you know.
Right. No, I like that. I didn't know that all tied in because we bought Ruby.
And it seems like you guys are going to keep her.
I tell her all the time. I know. The warranty has run out even. Yeah, so she's a princess, and it's fine. It's cute, and we're not going to begrudge her the thing she loves. No, you have to be a scientist.
I mean, it's here's your pocket protector and your slide rule. Aren't they fun?
That's right. There's plenty of time for no fun later in life.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, be more disturbed if she wants to be a princess when she's 14.
Right. Now, did you watch any scary movies and stuff as we're tailing off of Halloween? You're not super into those.
You know, we talked about it. We were trying to figure out what to watch. We ended up watching Shadow of the Vampire, which was
the original.
No, that was it was like the
The Willem Dafoe thing?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, which was, you know, of course, the role he was made for.
Now, was that scary? Isn't that just a biopic about the making of Nosferatu?
No, it's not scary at all. That okay. was, as we sat there and watched it and got deeper in, I was like, boy, I forgot this is really just an art film about right. how...
how to make movies?
Well, it's essentially, you know, a story about how a director would just assume kill everyone on the crew to get right. this movie made, which is what it is by the end. Malkovich is yelling over at
is he the director?
Armand Desante, who's been, you know, had his blood sucked out by William Dafoe. And he's like, uh-huh. could you move the cross to the right? This frame is not tenable.
This frame is not tenable. You should say that on set next time.
It's so good.
I never saw that. Was it good?
Oh, it's so funny. Yeah. I mean, it's
it is good.
It's kind of like the Peter Jackson King Kong, you know, where everybody keeps dying.
Oh, you mean terrible?
Well,
overlong and terrible?
No, it's an art film. It's not fun. It's not a Halloween movie. I, you know, about an hour and 10 minutes in it, I really regret it that I was like, oh, it's just never going to get scary. It just keeps getting weirder.
Yeah. I mean, I know that you like some of the new horror stuff that's like quality films, but I don't ever remember you as being a big, like,
a big
sort of hokey, slasher guy.
Although I did buy Halloween today.
Oh, yeah?
The original was on sale for like $7.
Digitally?
Yeah. So I bought an actual copy. I'm kind of getting to the point where I want to buy DVDs. I don't want to.
Oh, really?
I don't want to own something that's in a cloud someplace.
Right.
When Amazon splits off into something else. And
right. There go your movie.
Yeah.
There goes your movie collection.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Jeff
a good
Bezos
point.
Will take my movie collection to Mars.
Right. I have been watching a lot of movies because we did a slasher roundtable, and I'm not well versed in all those, and so I've been watching a lot of that stuff.
Would you? Did you see anything that?
I saw Black Christmas a couple of nights ago.
Mm-hmm.
Great movie. I saw a great one that everyone's tired of hearing me talk about called The Burning. Feature debut of Holly Hunter, Jason Alexander, and Fisher Stevens.
Wow.
Fisher Very Stevens. First movies.
Oh, my goodness.
It was really good. Watch one called...
Is Fisher Stevens one of the Hardy Boys?
No. Who were the Hardy Boys? It was... I'm actually going to look this up, which I rarely do. You mean the old TV show?
Yeah, or maybe he was in like the remake of or the TV movie of Jan and Dean.
Sean Cassidy and Parker Stevenson were the Hardy Boys.
I'm going down Fisher Stevens.
Fisher Stevens.
Yeah, where did that come from? Fisher Price. Yeah, Fisher Price.
Were you Jan or Dean? I saw Jan and Dean perform at what was it? I think it was the Charleston.
A clam bake?
No, it was the Charleston, West Virginia Regatta Festival. Which,
the clam bake.
Yeah.
And clam bake.
/ clam bake. Back when I worked at Stone Mountain Park and sold the glow-in-the-dark necklaces, my boss, you know, had contracts to do these little festivals all over the country.
Had a sweet connection for you.
He took us to Charleston to see that and Jan and Dean. It was so sad because, you know, Dead Man's Curve, one of them had, like, that bad car wreck.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was Jan or Dean, but it was the one that was up on stage, like, not doing well.
Yeah, I think let's just end that topic right there.
But the good ending to that story is, guess who also performed? A little band called Cheap Trick. So that was like my third or fourth of 10 times that I've seen Cheap Trick was at the Charleston Regatta Festival. Very good.
Well, and I think if you ask them, they still remember that show too.
How do we get down that road? We were talking about horror movies. I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first time.
What'd you think?
Thought it was fucking brutal and terrifying.
Yeah. Can you imagine really, watching it back in the day?
That's all I talked about. On the podcast was what in the fuck did people in 1974 think when they went to the movie theater?
I mean, talk about the dissolution of the nuclear family.
Yeah, you're so alike, my friend. So alike that I just realized on my video desktop right now on YouTube, I have a video called Mark Knopfler on Guitars that you would probably be interested in.
But remember when we were in Australia and Dire Straits was touring without a single original member of Dire Straits.
Yeah. I think there was one guy or something. But yeah, Dire Straits without Mark Knopfler is not Dire Straits.
Yeah. I was just like...
No good.
That cracks me up. You wonder how that happens. I feel like maybe, you know, when they split up, he put somehow like in the divorce settlement, he got the rights to... Well, you can tour...
As Dire Straits?
You can tour in the Southern Hemisphere. Right.
Well, he just tours as Mark Knopfler and you know what you're going to get. You're going to get some Dire Straits.
And Shushed if you sing along.
That's right. All right. horror movies. They were good.
Not to digress too far, what was that horror movie that there's like a Nick Cage horror movie that Clay tells me?
Oh, Mandy.
Mandy?
Yeah, I'm shocked that you haven't heard of that. Mandy was like a big deal. It's bonkers.
This last year, I really fell off my 100-plus movies a year at the theater. Kind of.
Yeah, you only saw 85?
Yeah, exactly.
Mandy was – you should definitely see it. I think my review, Noel – co-host Noel loves it.
I watched the trailer.
It's bananas. My review was 25-year-old Chuck would have loved it. 48-year-old Chuck was like, I get it. Mm. It didn't offend me, but
They're not making movies for us anymore.
They're really not.
18 to 25, chosen demographic.
Yeah, they made movies for us when we were like 11. They were making movies for 40-somethings.
Yeah. I watched Hocus Pocus. I think that's the biggest Halloween movie I watched. Lily was excited.
I've never seen that. I need to check that out. That's Ruby appropriate, right? Maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Dora Birch is like, young Dora Birch, probably like 7 or 8 years old.
But it didn't show like Bette Midler naked or anything.
Oh, God, no. I mean, it is a scary movie, but not that scary.
Hey-o!
All apologies to Bette Midler. That was low-hanging fruit.
I love Bette Midler.
I love Bette Midler, yes. I've seen beaches and not cry every time.
But we're finishing up Halloween. I have to put my scary movie stuff on pause for yet another year that I watch by myself because, Emily does not party that way.
Yeah, Lily doesn't really like them either, which was odd that she wanted to try and find a scary movie to watch.
Yeah, next time.
And it ended up being Hocus Pocus. So.
Yeah. And you haven't seen The Lighthouse yet still, or did you go see it?
No, I don't think it's out here in Atlanta yet.
Oh, really?
It might come out tomorrow.
Oh, well, see, I was in Manhattan.
Oh, this one time when I was in Paris.
I was in Manhattan. Yeah, I just happened to catch it when I was there, and it was I kind of want to go see it again. I was thinking about going to see it again with you, but just let me know when you go, and if I can, I will.
Well, I want to because you had that, you had that great idea for a lighthouse movie that was.
I know, never happened.
It was. You were right there in the.
Well, this is much better than what I wrote.
Well, the whole idea of lighthouse movies was floating around the ether. It was like right after that. There's been a series of lighthouse movies in the last few years.
I don't know what the deal is. Someone finally looked up and said, "What a great setting for a movie!
Yeah,
about scary isolation." I will say, I said this is a better movie than what I wrote. Which it is.
Well, it's just a different movie.
But it's a completely different movie than what I wrote.
Yeah, this is it seems like it's a much more internal psychological, like man versus solitary confinement kind of story.
Yeah, man versus nature, man versus man, man versus self.
Man versus seagull.
Man versus self flagellation, man masturbation.
Versus cornbread.
There is masturbation, by the way. So just get ready for that.
Well, I can't wait to see it with you.
Okay, everyone. Scotty is sitting across from me back for part two of our film noir series, and I'm letting you sort of drive the train as far as the movie picks, and you pick the movie from 2005 by a little director named Rian Johnson called Brick, which I know I saw, and I must have seen it in 2005 because I didn't remember any of it.
Really? What a treat.
No.
What a fun thing to get to
it was.
See it again for the first time.
And so much so that I was like, did I see this? And I was like, I think I did. Then I was like, but are you sure? Then I was like, I don't recognize these guys. Then I was like, I know Jordan. JGL is up there, and I've seen him before in a movie. But then I was like, am I really thinking of Third Rock from the Sun? And I was like, no, that's impossible. That was a TV show with John Lithgow.
Definitely the first time I saw him in something besides Third Rock. And I never watched Third Rock, but I knew who he was from that. And I remember seeing him in this and just thinking, wow, that guy can act.
Yeah, because this was sort of one of the first things he did after that, right? I mean,
the first thing I saw, he was a child actor, so he's probably got a ton of movies under his belt. But
he probably made a bunch of little Disney movies or
something. But he did this one, and then just 3 or 4 years later, he did 500 Days of Summer, which was
and then Looper.
Such a fun movie.
He seems like a good dude. And does he have a podcast? I want to say he has a podcast. Probably.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
he seems like a guy that would. But this was, we should go ahead and just talk about what a ballsy thing this movie was.
It was such a fun one, too, because, I guess we did Third Man last time, so we sort of started old school noir. And the great thing about this one is it's, 2000s. It's a great, and apparently Rian Johnson, went down the Dashiell Hammett rabbit hole. And
that's what I read.
Have
you ever read any of that stuff?
I have, yeah.
Is it good?
I think that's why I'm a big fan as well,
Yeah.
I always like thrillers because they're so intricately plotted. I like a good intricate plot, you know?
Boy, this one's intricate. I mean, so much so that it's hard to follow at times.
I was telling Tyler before he went out that I watched this a couple of weeks ago when we were first going to do it, and I didn't get a chance to watch it last night, and I'm hoping because I still remember all the twists because
Well, there are a lot of twists, but such a ballsy film, especially for a first-time filmmaker, to say, hey, you know what I'm going to do?
Hard-boiled detective story.
Hard-boiled detective film noir set in a high school. It was a hard sell. I think he took a lot of meetings before anyone – I don't think anyone greenlit it. I think he raised the money himself.
Yeah, I think as I recall, I think he's self-financed. But, I don't know how you sell this to someone, you know.
And the fine line he walked between he kept everything – he played it straight, which is the only way you could do this. Mm. But he kept the dialogue, that same snappy – noirish detective yarn dialogue.
Yeah, a lot of very cynical, hard-boiled detective talk. And just, you know, all the tropes. I mean, just it's funny by the end of it, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is just, he keeps getting beat up and he's throwing up blood. Uh-huh. And you know what I mean? That's like such a
classic.
That's
a noir-y thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like you just put the main dude through shit over and over.
By the end, he's just, you know, and he's still, you know, he constantly has the chance to turn around and just turn a blind eye to the injustice and save himself, and he won't. He just keeps staggering. And
I know. That's such a noir thing. It's like you beat the shit out of them, but it's not like they're superhero tough as nails. Like
it's not Captain America saying, I can do this all day.
They're hurting and beleaguered and like in every single one of these kind of tropey roles, and he pulls it off so well. He's just like – I mean, you think he's going to – Emily – kind of half watched the end, and she was like, "Why does he keep coughing?" So, like, I think he's just got like blood in his stomach from getting the shit kicked out of him, over and over and over.
Yeah, pretty much everybody beats him up or tries to beat him up, I think.
But he always gets back up and swings back hard, like he was tough, but without being a tough guy. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, he ends up beating up Brian White's character, the big man on campus.
Is that Tug or is that the first guy? Yeah. That guy was intimidating. I love he always had an answer like, what are you doing here? And he went, just listening. He always had a smart-ass answer that was really just truthful. But the fine line he walked, I think, as a director to doing the dialogue like this, playing it straight. There's only a couple of times where he even shows his tongue in his cheek, like the one great moment when – and we're kind of jumping around and we'll do some of it in order. But when he goes to finally meet the pen in the basement, and Lucas Haas is so good in this movie, and he plays this drug lord and he's got the cape and the cane. It's all creepy, and they're in this creepy basement. And then they smash cut to upstairs and his mom is trying to find like orange juice or milk or something.
Juice,
But that's only one of the few times he sort of plays with it a little bit.
Yeah, I think the whole pig character, that's what's so fun about it is like the stakes of the movie are high. I mean, somebody's already been killed, and here you are meeting, you know, who you think at this point is your John Huston, Chinatown, the baddest of the bad, and, you know, his mom's serving, you know, worried she doesn't have enough milk.
I can't find any juice.
Milk.
How about some milk?
I've only got 2%.
She was like, but you're having milk with your cereal because he had cereal in front of him.
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate kid thing. And the other thing with the fine line, I thought, was he could have very easily made, even though all the characters are straight out of the noir handbook, the brain, the femme fatale, the dame, like they're all right there. But he doesn't like, I guess the femme fatale and dame is sort of gussied up, but like he left Joseph Gordon-Levitt scruffy. Like he didn't make him this kid in a suit in high school with a fedora and slick back hair.
No,
like he left him a high school kid.
Yeah, yeah. No, he was definitely down on his luck. Well, you start the movie like, you know, he's been dumped,
right?
You know,
yes.
How does it open up again? I'm trying to remember.
Well,
find the body right off?
Yeah, the very first thing that happens is you open on that shot of him looking at the body.
That's right.
And then, in a very noirish way, it's just 2 days previous. Then you go back and you're going to find out how we got to this point.
That's such a fun opening for a movie. I always like those where it gives you something and then, you know, you start forgetting about it immediately because you're sort of overwhelmed taking in all this new information. And, you know, eventually you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. She's dead.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan not only of that, but even more specifically the movie that starts where it ends and then eventually ends up back in that same place.
Yeah.
Love that.
The old Memento.
So great.
Another movie that almost didn't get bought, apparently. Always makes me scratch my head when I
read that noir?
Someplace. Yeah, I'd call that
Could
noir.
We do that?
Absolutely.
All right. So. Yeah, let's tackle that one because I haven't seen that one, dude, in like maybe since it came out. I saw it a couple of times.
I mean, that's kind of the ultimate detective story because it's the guy trying to detect himself.
That's right. Joey Pants.
Joey Pants.
who's the main guy? What's his face? Guy Pearce. Mm-hmm. So good. But yeah, very noir opening. You've got this dead body, then it goes back. And it also kind of struck me as like, and then I confirmed later on that my instinct was right. Rian Johnson admitted that David Lynch was a big influence. But this sort of felt like to me like Lynchian, and like if David Lynch made a high school movie, it would sort of feel like this a little bit.
Yeah, he would have just found Emily's ear.
Right. Yeah, because Lynch isn't fully noir, but he dances in that world a lot. You know,
yeah, his are just so bizarre noir.
Mm-hmm. Biz noir,
biz noir
is what Snoop Dogg would call it.
Copyright patent pending, along with Four Pete and Taco Tuesday.
Oh God! Didn't LeBron James try and fucking patent Taco Tuesday? Are you kidding me, dude?
I think he did it sort of tongue-in-cheek because he was doing Taco Tuesday, like sort of social media with his family.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He was getting grief from some company over it.
So he's like, I'll just buy it.
And then the article I saw was like Taco Tuesday goes back to like the 40s or something. You know?
Oh, okay.
Like, you know,
I thought it was some dickhead move.
Maybe it was, but it seemed almost to be like he was just sort of saying, really, guys?
Really?
Am I going to have to like copyright it?
I'm going to lawyer up over Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesday with the kids.
I love that scene. Well, I love the brain, or I love brain as the character. Like,
I love Lamp.
It's such a you're just naming things you see in the room, aren't you? It's such a noir-y thing to, you know, not only this one character who seems to have all the knowledge and all the street knowledge, but always meeting up in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's usually a newspaper reporter, and they meet in the public library and talk between the bookshelves. But in this case, it's just like the outside of the high school.
Yeah, exactly. They meet out back.
And it's
great too because it's a detective story. So he's, you know, he's like his private. It's like a private detective with his assistant. You know?
Yeah,
it's
like, he's got his little assistant, but you never see him.
She would be like his secretary in a, you know, give me those files on the Heathcliff endeavor.
Yeah. Give me the McKendrick file, stat. The very first time we meet Brain though, when they're passing the Rubik's Cube back and forth, it's just again such a little like tongue in cheek nod because in the old school noir version, like that would be a gun one of them is cleaning or something. And then he would hand them to the guy and he would sight it or something. In this case, it's a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
It's so great.
If only it had Pokemons on it.
Did it really?
No.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I had a Rubik's Cube that had Pac-Man on it when I was in school.
Oh, really?
So that's a association in my head. Uh-huh. Rubik's Cube and Pac-Man are forever married because
I didn't know that mashup happened.
Oh my God. couldn't have been happier for a seventh grader.
the other cool thing about this movie and what he did here was it kind of struck me last night that he kind of introduced noir to a new generation. I mean, this wasn't some blockbuster movie that all the kids went and saw, but it was a high school movie that I'm sure a lot of young people saw this movie, maybe because JGL was in it and had no idea what film noir was.
Yeah.
And we're probably like, what the fuck am I watching? You know, with this dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't far off. I mean, I was probably, 34, 35 when it came out. So I certainly knew about noir, but I mean, you know, not as much as I know now. And,
yeah.
You know, but it was definitely movies like this, you know, updated noirs that got me interested in the old noir. So, yeah.
And he was faithful to it. You know, he had the jazzy score, didn't do black and white, which could have been cool.
Probably smart not to do black and white. I mean, it was shot on film.
Yeah.
Black and white's tough. I mean, it's tough to do well, I think. You know?
Right. Just wait till you see the lighthouse. It's gray. It's not even black and white. It's not like these great sharp contrasty colors. It's sort of just a dismal gray.
That reminds me of The Road. Remember Cormac McCarthy, the movie?
Yeah.
Man, I just wanted to like open my veins in a hot bath after that. I was just so
bad.
Depressed.
Yeah.
That movie was just brown.
Did you read the book?
I couldn't read the book.
Yeah, I read the book too. I read it, I think, before I saw the movie.
I tried to read the book.
It's tough.
Recently, actually, because I read No Country for Old Men. But
that's a good one too.
That movie just, you know.
He's had a great track record with adaptations. We were talking about that on another show. Like, most of his books have become really good movies.
Yeah, yeah. He was, you would think Stephen King would kill to have that track record. He's had a lot of stinkers.
Yeah, he really has. It's funny. I want to read you this review real quick. Speaking of people being confused by this movie. This was on just, I guess you can just leave a Google review or something.
Is this for this movie?
Yeah, for okay. Brick. Like any old schmo can just leave a review and it can pop up on like page one Google. I'm not going to name this person because I don't want to embarrass them. This is only a month ago. Overall, the concept of this movie is great. However, in detail, the movie has issues. It seems like a mix between a movie a film major made for a final project and a professional who uses way too much slang because they think it's cool. The movie had incredible shots, and I love all of the shoe scenes. It gets better.
I can think of a shoe scene right off the bat. So, yes, they definitely watched the movie.
There are a few shoe scenes. The characters were way too mature for high schoolers. Who uses that much slang, innuendo, and figurative language in high school? But the movie did talk about how Brendan did take an accelerated English class. So I guess that makes sense. There are a bunch of problems with this movie, but it was Ryan's first film. And if you take long enough, you can find the solutions in the story. What does that even mean?
I love it that they noticed that everybody was a little bit too mature for high school.
Right, and he talked in a weird way, but they did mention he took an accelerated English class.
Yeah, I could explain things.
So they don't know what film noir is, clearly.
Well, they were probably puzzled how Lucas Haas was a drug dealer in his mother's basement as well. But
yeah, I forgot about him, and I was just so impressed with his performance. He was so cool and intimidating, but then also like fit right in sitting in his mom's kitchen.
Yeah. It was such a weird movie. It was funny, like that scene later when they go to the beach and they're just sitting on the beach together.
Yeah, that's a great sequence, actually. Like, there's not a ton of super impressive cinematography in here, but that was some of the best.
Well, they didn't have a lot of money, so they didn't have a lot of time.
Right.
So I think
like 500 grand or so, 20 days.
As I often say, money solves most problems in the film business. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have money, you don't get to solve a lot of those problems. Cinematography is probably way up there.
Yeah, but you know what? I feel like if someone gave you and I $500,000 in 20 days, we could make a pretty decent little movie.
Or we just disappear to Mexico for 3 weeks.
And live for 5 years. Yeah, I mean, he didn't try to make it. I think I read that too, that he didn't focus on really doing all the noirish sort of cinematography tropes.
Yeah, I don't think he didn't go for. I mean, there certainly are some Levalor blinds in there. There's a few blind patterns.
There are, but that's true.
You know, it's not like it was all shot at night, which certainly on film increases your cost if you're trying to shoot at night.
Yeah.
And, daylight yep. dependent is the
available
cheap way
hours.
To shoot. Yeah,
yeah, and he did do a few things. You're right, but I think in the article I read, he said that he was really concentrating on story and the acting and the performance, and that he spent a lot of, which is a luxury when you don't have a lot of money. He was able to spend a lot of time rehearsing.
Yeah, which is interesting because you got, Brian White, Megan Good, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Lucas Haas. You know, you wouldn't think that he necessarily had a lot of time with them, but if you're living in California, maybe.
Yeah, and some of those people were pretty new, though, at the time. Like, I didn't know who Megan Good was at all, and I looked her up after, and she's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the first time I remember seeing her. She's so great in that kabuki makeup.
Oh, man. She was really good in this movie.
Yeah.
She was, I don't know, like, I'm sure Noir.
I believe I worked with her in Stomp the R2.
Oh, really?
I had the privilege of working on Stomp 1 and 2.
Oh, nice. I'm sure these have names, like Noir names, like the Dame and the Femme Fatale or whatever, but mm-hmm. Do you know what she would have been?
I don't know what you would call her.
Floozy? Yeah,
she's definitely another floozy.
She's really good, and it's a vital role in any movie like this. It's sort of the same purpose as Brain in a way.
She was a bit of a red herring, really, wasn't she? Because
well,
he was
true.
Always going to her looking for stuff, and maybe he got pieces from her, but Emily turns out to be the femme fatale and the
right.
The real.
That's right.
The real culprit. There are some great shots, though. Even the cinematography might not have been great, but like that, that one of those opening scenes where the black Mustang speeds by and the cigarette mm-hmm. drops in the frame. I mean, that's such an easy shot to do because the yeah. camera's just sitting there and you drop it and it seems like it came out of the car, but that's it's right. so cool, you know?
Yeah, it marries together well in an edit room.
And it has that little blue, there's like a little blue X or something on the...
It was a blue arrow.
Yeah, on the filter. That
led his gaze to the other payphone, mm-hmm. which doesn't pay off until the last, you know, the Scooby-Doo ending. Where he's like, well, let me tell you how it went down.
Zoinks.
And I was wondering last night, I was like, is he really going to do that? Because I thought it was just sort of playing with that trope. But he did.
Well, it's almost Agatha Christie in a way, too, or one of those where, or you know, Hercule Poirot is going to tell everyone.
Right.
There, you know.
Here's what happened.
Yeah.
Clue. Like, that's
everyone's sitting around yeah. and all, you know, everything's going back and forth. Well, let me tell you what happened.
Yeah. It's pretty great. Just in case you didn't catch it. And this movie needed that. Because it was legit sort of hard to follow at times.
One of the things I loved about it is, you know, it all ties together right there at the end, the brick of heroin that's missing.
Right, because those are the words she said, brick, the pen, the guy's name that OD'd on the bad brick.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember what his name was in yeah. the movie. But it's sort of all tied together. But, I mean, this is one of my favorite things about noir movies or any kind of movie that does this. So it starts... Like, you don't know what happens until the very end.
Yeah. Yeah. And a good one certainly keeps you guessing all the way to the end. And I think that one of the things I liked about this, too, is like, unlike Hitchcock, you know, who always like, you know, the MacGuffin isn't really that important. Usually yeah. that thing, you know, like the microfilm in North by Northwest. Who cares about the microfilm right. by the end of that movie? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't even care about it you don't know what it is for most of the movie. And then when you find out it's microfilm and that little statue, you're like,
right.
so what? Is Cary Grant going to fall off the face of Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, that's what matters. Exactly.
But in this one, the brick actually matters at the end.
It's, yeah.
In a sense, like it's the thing, as he's telling her, he's like, you know, even at the end, she's trying to coax him in to be with her. And he's like, well, yeah. I'd love to, but this is what I said happened. You know, basically, at the end, he's like, he's written to the authorities, which is the principal.
A.K.A. Shaft.
Yeah, Richard Roundtree.
Roundtree.
What a great role for him.
The vice principal. It's so great. He was the guy.
Yeah, he was the – and they had some – and he was like, you know, he was the police basically. He was,
yeah,
he was like the police chief that hauls in the detective and says, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
Spade, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's like, oh, but we're all on the same team. We want the same thing.
Yeah, it's like Sam Spade getting hauled into, you know, before the police, you know.
Captain Chumley.
Because so many times in those movies, the detective used to be a police officer and he
right.
left you know, think about Chinatown. He used to be on the police force.
That's right.
Because
some incident,
the police force
usually.
Was dirty and he.
Right.
I guess not that Jake Eddings was the cleanest guy. And
well,
but.
What I still didn't quite follow was JGL or Brendan, he went away for a little while and came back from school. And I still can't figure out exactly what had happened.
Well, I think he turned somebody in, right? Or he ratted on somebody. Something was going on that he got somebody in trouble. I can't remember but he was doing the right thing as far
right.
as I recall. Because
I should bring up plot synopsis.
Because I feel like he tells Richard Roundtree that, you know, I'm not your.
Yeah, I'm not your.
I'm not your spy or your stooge.
Yeah,
or
yeah, yeah. That was
like the thing
was
I did was.
It was very convoluted. I mean. That's one way to say it. It was very complex. It's
yes.
a more kind way to say it. Because convoluted appears like accidentally confusing. But
well, he was in an advanced English class, so right. it really all made sense after I saw his schedule.
I love, too, at the beginning he goes to that party, which is the Halloween in January, which is the least high school party in any high school movie ever.
Yeah, exactly. It was like
it's very Stanley Kubrickian.
Yeah, that's where they spent all their money. Expected it to turn into a giant high school orgy at any second. Everybody's
totally
like Brian White was like dressed like in a toga and
everything. Oh yeah,
wasn't it like a toga party or?
I mean, it was Halloween in January, so they were dressed as all kinds of things. But yeah, he was definitely Greco-Roman.
I guess everybody goes with certainly when you're younger. There's lots of sexy costumes. All guys and girls are trying to show skin and
yeah. Apparently, that house though was a location that they got because. The rich guy who lived there was going to renovate it the next week and said, yeah, sure, go ahead. Just
nice.
Know, lock up when you leave, that kind of thing. So you know how it is with filmmaking. You can get to these little kind of sweetheart deals like, oh, I've got a mansion that's going to be torn down next month. Like, we got 2 days and we can use this thing that would have cost us so much money that this rich guy didn't really care about getting paid for.
Bring all 14 lights. Let's shoot this thing.
I kind of wondered at times, too, if, and I found out I was wrong because it was always conceived as a high school version. But at times I was wondering, like, did he just write this as a
real noir or, well, standard noir?
Standard noir and then just retrofit it to be, like, different. And that's apparently not the case.
Well, I mean, he was young, so it probably made sense. I mean, I don't know if this is his first film. I'm sure he probably has.
I think it was his first film.
Right.
In his early 30s. And he shot it at where he went to high school. He shot it at his high school, San Clemente.
Always something to be said for that. I mean, isn't Rushmore like shot at the academy that?
I think one of the schools was, it was either the public school or Rushmore
was the one that he
was where Wes Anderson.
Yeah, I mean, what a treat to be able to shoot your first movie in your.
Oh man, my high school's not photogenic.
The place that formed you. Well, but it formed you.
That's true. My high school famously had no windows. Well, so it was.
We could go back to that office where you and Jim did the morning report,
yeah, morning radio show. The girl in the red dress, who what was her name in the movie?
Not Emily, of course.
No, Emily's the one that died. It was Kara.
Well, that was Megan Good.
Oh no, you're right, Laura.
Yeah, Laura turns out to be the femme fatale, right?
Yeah, but Laura was the one that, and I apologize if it sounds like I'm floundering, but there were just a lot of similarly named people.
It was, I mean, that's the thing about, I mean, I would be hard-pressed to walk you through the Maltese Falcon right now, turn for turn. That movie,
yeah.
Like every time I watch it again, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right, that little thing right there.
This is sort of the same way. When I was watching this last night, I was a little bit, not worried, but I was like, geez, when we talk about this, this is going to be tough. We're not going to be able to go beat for beat here.
You're like, I need a flow chart.
It's very confusing. But the long story short is Emily has died, and he is now on the trail to solve her murder through this group of friends. And we realized that Emily had gotten wrapped up in a local high school drug ring.
Yeah, it's such a great tie into high school because basically Emily, he wants to be with her. He has he feels, and he seems to have her best interest at heart, but mm-hmm. she wants to be popular. It's
right.
such a great tie into high school, you know, and,
yeah.
and she, you know, that quest to be popular ends up killing her.
Yeah, and that one scene, the only one with he and Emily, was really, really good. She was terrific.
And that's after she's called him, asking for help. He mm-hmm. actually, well, she puts a note in his locker.
Right.
And he's on the phone. She calls for help. And then he sees her, and she's like, oh, everything's fine.
Right.
And he knows it's not. So.
Yeah, and she's just like, just leave me alone. Like, if you really cared about me, just get over me and leave me alone.
Yeah.
Everything's good. And he's like, no.
And it all plays off that powerful opening of him finding the body. And then at the end, as he finds the body, the last thing you see is him carrying the body into the tunnel.
Right.
So what?
Which is plot point one.
Yeah.
30 minutes.
What did he do with the body?
He hid it.
But
he didn't show it.
But you know what I mean? It's like, as you're watching, you're like, what's he doing?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't he, you know, why didn't he call the police? Why didn't he?
Right.
But of course, he wants to solve it. He's afraid that, classic detective, the police will foul this up.
Yeah.
I have
exactly.
to solve it.
I got to handle it. I'm the only person who can solve this. But it's not so clear. Like, he doesn't declare these things. It just sort of unfolds. And also in that scene, we realize someone else is in the tunnel. Which we don't know who this is until much later.
Oh, that's right. He does hear someone running from the other end or something.
That's
or
right.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, someone sees him move the body.
Yeah.
And that turns out to be Dode.
Oh, Dode, yeah.
Who is the punker who is, well, he's with Emily. Isn't that right? Isn't that who she's with initially?
Yeah.
Because there's the whole mystery of mm-hmm. whose baby is it?
Yeah.
Because at one point we think it's Dode. And I think it's the.
And I think later on, Laura tells Tug, who is Penn's.
Thug.
The Penn's
Tug. Tug is the thug.
Tug the thug.
He's the muscle.
I think, yeah, Tug ends up dating her.
Right. And thinks it's his kid, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it all gets messed up. But then we find out in the end, in the very, very end, that it was. And in the most brutal way possible. Because remember the line she says. She told me that she couldn't be with the father because she didn't love him.
Yeah, well,
and it was 3 months ago. So you know whose baby that makes it.
Well, yeah. So she's, but that's after she realizes that he's turned her in. So
oh yeah, sure.
So I always wondered,
was she just saying
is that true or is she just
interesting.
She just the only thing she can do is hurt him
right
this way.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
But, you know, either way, it's a brutal line.
Yeah, it is a very brutal line. Yeah. There's a lot of great lines in this movie.
But it's one of those things that brings it full circle, too, that after you realize that he's turned her in, and uh-huh. she says that, you're like, well, I'm glad he turned her. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, because up until then, she never lets on that, you know, he realizes she's the one that set Emily up, that uh-huh. she stole the brick, all this, and that's the right. first time she does something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true.
But it confirms it that, you know, whether she would make that up or lie, either way.
Yeah.
What a horrible person.
Well, the one part that it didn't quite fully get and that it's explained away in a way that wasn't fully satisfying to me was when he beats up Brad. I didn't get why he did that. And in the movie, it sort of explained like, well, you know, he's a big customer of the pen and now I've got his attention. I've got the pen's attention. And I thought that was one of the only sort of weaker threads in this film.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't fully grasp that, but it's fine.
I mean, I guess I buy it in a noir sense of he's messing up his nefarious crime operation, so we're going to have to deal with him, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. That makes a little bit of sense.
But the high school thing makes it a little bit.
Yeah.
So that's someplace where the high school thing sort of weakens the noir thing because you're like, oh, so what? Somebody beat somebody up in high school?
Yeah, there were times where,
wah.
Yeah, I think the high school thing definitely didn't fully support the thing.
It didn't raise the stakes that he was, you know.
But it also allowed you to do some fun stuff, like when he has that initial meeting with the vice principal. He has that whole spiel, and at the very end he gets up and goes, I'll see you at the parent-teacher conference. Another one of the few times. And he also says, too, this is another great line, he's like, I'm just telling you now so you don't go kicking in my homeroom door when the trouble starts. Oh, man. I mean, he had a little bit of a sense of humor about it, but he largely played it straight.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it was, you know, set in high school is pretty loose because it was basically set outside of a high school. I don't think
there's any high school scenes, are there, really?
Yeah, I think Roundtree's office is the only place that – the only interior, maybe a library.
Maybe, but it did feel like – and this might have been a nod to sort of those 80s high school movies where you felt like they were never in class.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, when are they actually going to school?
I think I told you I watched – E.T. with Lily for the first time. She'd never seen it.
And, uh-huh.
she'd walked away going, where were their parents?
Oh, it was a different time.
And I bust her all the time now, like with Hocus Pocus. I'm like, where are their parents?
Is that your go-to criticism?
Oh, yeah. I heard like Frozen. I'm like, where are their parents? She's like, they're shipwrecked. I'm like, exactly.
Oh, that's funny. I'm going to start saying that too. I'm going to actually, don't tell her you told me this. I'm just going to say that next time I'm around her and something's going on. Where are their parents? Then we get that great scene with Tug and the Mustang when he goes and he's about to bust into it with the cinder block.
He sees it in the and he comes like flying at him.
Well, he just comes walking like, you know, a bat out of hell, and he's just so intimidating. This kid, you know, in the white tank top and the like the sock on his head, but he's muscly and he's fucking angry, and you learn that the pen is scared of his own muscle, because he's out of control.
Because he's not just a violent guy. He's a screw-loose violent guy.
Yeah, which is not someone you want on your team. But that's such a great scene because he kicks the shit out of him. He keeps getting back up.
And that's one where he keeps telling him he wants to meet Brain, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
He wants, not the pen. He wants to meet
Brain. Yeah, he wants to meet the pen. And so then he gets in the car, and I think they ramp up the speed, uh-huh. So it pulls out of there so fast, and he throws the rock at it. He stops for a minute. Then leaves, wait a few beats, and then he comes back.
And another great, maybe not great cinematography, but a wonderfully effective shot where he like stops right on a dime before he runs him over, basically, doesn't he? And that how that
– yeah.
He, which, like he's going to run him over and he just stops.
Yeah, and you're a filmmaker. You know how they do that. But for those of you listening, what they do is they shoot that in reverse with the car. You know, they start right up on that bumper and then the car backs away. And at whatever speed, and then you speed up the film, reverse it, and that's how you get someone seemingly dangerously close to running someone over. The end.
Absolutely.
It's a pretty good trick.
That's the gospel.
It still works.
Well, it's such a great trick for lots of things. When you need to nail focus on something super tiny or something, like, you know, if you can ever shoot it in reverse and start in focus and then out of focus, then, you know what I mean? Certainly for static shots, you know,
uh-huh.
Sometimes that's the easiest way to
I think they did that for another shot at the iconic tunnel when I think it's when Emily walks out. I think they had her walk backwards into the tunnel and did it a certain way so the trash could float in the right direction toward Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
So, cool. You know, solving problems.
I'll have to pay attention to that, yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, things can always go backwards. It wasn't for today.
Also love the scene when he first meets first of all, Tug is sort of a dum-dum because he
is Tug.
He throws him in the trunk to take him over there blindfolded supposedly, and he's able to crack the trunk and see where he's going the whole time.
Yeah.
Which turns out to be like his little trick on how to get out of there. He's got this information now.
Mm-hmm.
Like he knows
how to find the pin again. Isn't that how
exactly. Yeah, exactly. He's like, I know where we are. But when he first gets thrown into the room with the pen and he looks up and everything's out of focus and then he puts on his glasses and it snaps into focus. That was such a fun little nod, I think. I love that stuff.
Well, that's when the story heats up too, because basically in order to solve Emily's death, he has to get inside the pen's operation, and he basically tells him he wants to do it. And I definitely remember the part where the pin basically tells him, he's like, by tomorrow you either be part of the team or I'll have you rubbed out.
Yeah. You'll know within 24 hours.
Which is, great for Lucas Haas to use those words.
It was great. Well, and he knows that sort of confuses the next thing that happens, which is Brendan gets chased down by the slasher who knifes him in the arm. And I thought, and I think you're supposed to think, that that was the answer, is you're going to get rubbed out.
Yeah, that the pin had sent him is what you're supposed to think.
Yes, but you don't find out again until the end, the very end, when the last time he talks to Brain, that I think it was Dode.
Or that was Brad.
No, it was Brad.
Who he had beaten up the football star.
Yeah, he had sent the slasher after him, which has a legit good, great foot chase. And then the best
Of a foot chase.
The best ending to a foot chase I've ever seen.
Well, it's just such a great little noir twist. It's so weird. Like, he runs around the corner and takes his shoes off as fast as he can.
I was like, why is he doing that? So he couldn't hear him, I guess?
I guess so, but it's just...
It was a little weird.
It's believable enough in that, like, sort of heightened world of noir, but it's also very Coen Brothers kind of funny.
It was very Coen.
It's like Blood Simple when he shoots him in the office.
Right.
And he doesn't move, and you're like, is he dead? Did
right.
he shoot him? Did
yeah.
he?
Yeah, this definitely had a little Coen's DNA.
Yeah.
And that great, again, with just sort of filmmaking on the cheap and little tricks you can do with sound and visuals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see him trip the guy, and then you just hear, dong. You don't actually have to film the guy running into the pole, which requires a stunt person and...
He basically
coverage.
He trips him out of frame, I think, and then the camera pans, and by then
the sound effect just happened,
and he's on the ground, and you know what happened.
He's on the ground right by the pole.
Yeah, problem solved.
It was so funny, and just such a weird ending to that scene. But this is when you sort of, like you said, the movie really kind of heats up when he learns that Emily had tried to join Penn's gang, was rejected, supposedly steals the brick, is what we think at this point, and he finally hires Brendan. After this foot chase, that's the beach scene, I guess, is where he tells him he's sort of in. And that's where he reveals, too, that
he thinks Tug is.
Yeah, Tug is worrisome for him. And Brendan certainly plays on that vulnerability,
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, yes, Tug is not good news. Uh-huh. I'm the right guy for the job.
Yeah, it felt very Miller's Crossing. You feel like a Gabriel Byrne going to going in and changing sides, so that he can ferret out what's really going on, basically.
Yeah, Miller's Crossing is like all these movies. You have to put your thinking cap on a little bit,
Nobody is what they seem for sure. Everybody's lying or hiding something, which is like I said, that's one of the things I love about noir is the intricate plotting. Certainly I love a good character study, Leaving Las Vegas or whatever, but. There's something satisfying about these. They're such puzzles that when it fits together really well,
it's impressive.
There's no holes, you're like, oh, that's really well thought out.
Yeah, because I think you and I both as writers and screenwriters we always have had a Jones to do something like this. Or fucking Rian Johnson is now doing the other thing we always wanted to do.
Making a Star Wars movie.
But I'm talking about Knives Out.
Yeah.
which is the Agatha Christie, you know, 10 people in a room and one of us did it. You and I have always talked about writing something like that. And one of the reasons we haven't is because it's so intimidating, I think, because it's so hard to do really well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, when the older you get, you realize, boy, it's tough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think you're young, you're like, oh, I'm just going to crank one of these out.
Yeah. Knives Out is supposed to be great, too. We've got to see that one together.
It's funny, especially after we did your show, How Stuff Works, the TV show we did.
Stuff You Should Know.
Man, we had so many characters in that show. There were so many people. And it was always such a challenge to get everybody on camera because there'd be 14 people in a room. And I faced that many times since then in work. And I now carry a picture from Agatha from Murder on the Orient Express.
Oh, really?
Where they're all in the train car and there's 16 people in the shot and you can see every one of their faces.
Oh, wow.
And that's what I show to big groups now when they're like, I'm like, this is how you find the camera. I was like.
Well, how is it? What's the secret?
You, as an actor, you just have to look and make sure you can see the lens.
Oh, okay.
If you can't see it, it can't see you. But it's hard with young actors. They don't get it. They're like, I'm right here. What do you mean you can't see me? And it's just
right.
The nature of a lens or something. It's like, well, you know, this lens is, you know, the field of view is more narrow. So you're just right there. But you're, you know, the curvature of the lens, you're behind them now. I don't see your face, or I only see one eye, and it's like, we want to see you. You're important.
Yeah.
That's why we've hired you to be an actor.
Like,
we want to see your face.
Right.
But it is hard when you have 15 people in a shot. You know?
Yeah.
That's difficult.
Yeah.
Plus, you want actors to be acting and doing their thing and not worried about you. But that's one of those rare times where there has to be a good dance, right?
Yeah. Did you see the wasn't that remade, Orient Express?
Kenneth Branagh did it, which I thought was...
Was it good?
It seemed a bit tone deaf. It seemed a little like a male take on it.
Oh, interesting.
Well, more male than Agatha Christie's take.
Right.
I mean, it was fun. I mean, you know, it's...
Not great, though.
We sort of lost our sense of humor, you know.
It's like, yeah.
You know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have said that, but now...
Right.
I'm like, well, the feminine perspective was...
was lost.
It was lost, you know.
Well, we got to see Knives Out together.
But it was fun. Yeah, I will see that. I feel like we're in a bit of a movie dearth right now. I'm looking forward to...
Yeah, I mean, things should be heating up here in the holiday season, Oscar bait and whatnot.
Yeah, I guess we are sort of in the doldrums between summer and...
Yeah, that's the worst, man. The worst time of the year.
Summer and Thanksgiving,
that
Christmas.
And then post, like, the beginning of the year, January through March is pretty brutal, too.
Boy, anything that comes out like January 12th,
you just... it might as well be called studio garbage. It's like we have to release this sometime.
We're sorry, America, coming to you to a theater near you, January 12th.
So at this point... Brendan gets the call from Dode, who fully believes that he has killed Emily because he's the one that was in the tunnel and he's the one that saw him with the body.
Yeah, Dode believes our hero, Brendan, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, killed her.
Yeah, and he's like, no, man, it wasn't me. And it was a really good scene. All the acting in this movie is really good, I thought.
Well, and he has good reason to believe he saw him with the body. He's her jilted lover. And, of course, Dode wants to get even with him because he was... Isn't Dode who Emily was with right after Brendan?
Yeah, I think so.
Before she was with Tug.
Right. Yeah.
Which I guess was, you know, her last-ditch attempt to get into the cold
drug
gang.
I guess so, maybe, because Tug was certainly not, a real catch in any way.
No, he was just
seemed like a big dum-dum. He had a cool car, I guess that was.
And, well, he's the one that actually kills Emily, right? He kills her after Laura tells him that
the baby was Dode's.
Yeah, boy, Laura really does suck.
She does.
She gets Emily killed.
It was you all along. Not you, her. Things are really heating up, though. And one of the things that this movie does, which I think is really cool, that a lot of noir films do really well, is the story gets a momentum where it feels like no one is controlling it. And it's kind of like... It's building on itself, and it's like it's in control of itself.
I think that's exactly one of the things I really love about him. Well said, is that the story takes on a life of itself. It's like all these events have been set in motion, and
and
it's going to have to play out no matter what. There's nobody's in control anymore. No character can say, "Oh, I'm not going to go fight the dragon," or "I'm not going to attack the Death Star."
Yeah, and
you know,
come to think of it, Laura even has a line that sort of alludes to that. It might be a nod and a wink where he's talking about going to that final meeting with Tug in the pen.
Don't do it.
Yeah, and she's like, don't do it. And she's like, it's going to play out how it's going to play out, whether or not you're there. Like, In other words, the story has a life of its own at this point.
Well, such a great and essential trope of the noir is just that post-World War II cynicism of like, you know, fatalism that things are going to be what they're going to be, you know.
Yeah.
You're not going to be – how many times has the detective got that femme fatale that if he just turned the other way and ignored the injustice, he'd get the hot girl and, you know, but he never can.
No, he never can. He snoops around Penn's house, and that's where he finds that cash and the brick of drugs in the other room, and that's where Tug gets to him.
Is it Tug? Somebody knocks him out, right?
Or, yeah, it's Tug.
And he wakes up and the brick is gone. And basically, once he wakes up, the brick is gone, and then, like, there's a war. Like, Penn and Tug are...
Uh-huh. They're at war with each other.
But he wakes up in Tug's. Like, Tug takes him, right?
Yeah, he takes him home. And he tells him, he's like, you're at my house with my folks.
With my people.
And he's like, you're with us now. And
don't they all wear T-shirts or something, too?
Yeah,
and there's something
they
like
all
very...
They the white tank tops.
Yeah, they're very much a...
Yeah, and you can't... And you just see a couple of them passing by. But that's a great line, too. And he said, like, you're with us now or whatever. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt's just waking up. And he goes, the hell I am. And he tries to get out of there. But I think he realizes what he's got to do. And he can't just split at that moment.
Well, he realizes he's going to have to sneak out. But even like you said, his line is like, the hell I am. It's like, you know, your noir guy is never going to pretend to be someone he's not, you know. He's,
right.
he's always going to speak his truth, and that's why he keeps getting beaten up. And
yeah, you know. Yeah. And that leads to the great scene, you know, where they have to meet at the tunnel, which we didn't mention the note that looks like a sort of the Anarchy A, and they were trying to figure out what that was at the beginning.
That was an interesting little story plot device with Brian telling him he's like that apparently, like, I guess I forget what they call them, the Socias, something like that, the rich kids. Like, they use these little pictographs so they can have secret meetings without giving it away.
I thought that was funny.
Because it's not seen anywhere else. I don't think there's another pictograph anywhere. It's only
one
of the tunnel.
Yeah.
But it's such a sort of obtuse plot device that he gets away with because.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are a couple of these things I think that have first-time filmmaker attached to it. It doesn't make the movie any worse. But, like, that probably seemed really important at the time.
It almost makes it better in a sense that he created such an intricate little world, you know? You're kind of like, eh, right?
Yeah, for sure. I want to go get my picture taken in front of that tunnel. It's pretty great.
Apparently it's, like, near the high school or something. Like,
yeah, it's right there in San Clemente, Orange County.
There's probably a dozen of them that you'll be like, which one is it?
But that scene, man, when they all meet down there, it's, like, very tense.
Well, it's so great because somebody's going to get killed. You got, you basically got Brain, or you've got Dode, Penn,
Tug,
and him.
Brendan, yeah.
And Dode's in the process of, he's about to unload to Penn and tell him that Brendan is the one that killed Emily. And Tug is such a meathead, he doesn't realize that he's about to get away with it scot-free. And
he's over there just ripping up that grass. He's getting more and more fucking worked up.
Yeah, and he ends up killing him, doesn't he? Doesn't he kill Dode?
Or? Yeah, I mean, he beats the shit out of him and then blows his fucking head off tunnel.
Like, yeah, I couldn't remember if he killed him or just beat him silly.
Yeah, he beats him silly and then blows his head off with a revolver. And just the filmmaking-wise, like, that's a great little set. You know, that static shot of that tunnel, because you can just, the way you place people around that set is really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a proscenium arch. There it is.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true.
It's like playing it on a stage there.
It's like the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
With a sewer river running through it.
And a river runs through it.
Such a great scene, though. Like, so tense. I found myself, like, super, like, anxiety. My body was tensed up during that whole scene because I couldn't really remember what happened.
Yeah. Maybe that's one of my favorite things about noirs, too, is that there's so many intricate beats that no matter how many times I see them, I tend to forget beats here and there, and I'm pleasantly surprised. They're like delicious little bites of food when you come across them again. It's like getting that – it's like when the last pistachio out of the bag is the best one. You're just like, oh, man. All right, that's a good little nugget. Yeah.
He has his moment of love again with his ex, Laura, and that's when he spies the cigarette butt with the blue arrow.
Oh, that's right. That's when he ties it all together.
That's when it all comes together. And you don't really know for sure what that means still at this point. You just know that that's a cigarette that fell out of the car.
That Emily was scared of.
Exactly.
Initially.
But what we don't know is that she because was on a different payphone.
Because there's such a great misdirection there too, because that car is Tug's car, so you think.
Right. But what we learn, though, is that she was on the other side of the street and looking in the driver's window.
Mm-hmm.
That Laura was driving, I guess, right? Or no, would that have been Tug?
Yeah, somehow Emily sees Laura, and that's who she's scared of, not Tug.
Right, exactly.
Because at that point, Tug and her are dating.
Yeah. Right, okay. That even makes more sense now.
And then Emily turns Tug on her because Tug kills her.
Right.
Man. Yeah, see, the more you talk about it, the more, you know, that's what's so fun about them.
Yeah, here's what I would not recommend either is getting super stoned and watching this movie. I would know from experience, but this is a movie that's probably best followed very sober.
Yes, I've seen studies.
He also sets Tug up as he leaves. You know, you've got this brutal scene at the end with the meeting where Tug ends up like the cops raid and Tug beats Penn to death.
Yeah.
Is what you hear as he's leaving.
And somehow Joseph Gordon-Levitt escapes all that, right?
He did. I mean, he had the gun in his hand and the whole time I was like, what you kind of think is going to happen is the cops are going to come down there and shoot him because he's holding the gun.
Yeah.
And you're just going like, put the gun down, man, put the gun down, which he does. And he kicks it out of the way. And as he's leaving, he flies out of the house and he passes the trunk of Tug's car where he has – that's where Emily's body ended up because he wanted to make sure that Tug got, you know, nailed for it.
Wanted to make sure the person who did it, once again, you know, his goal the whole time was to make sure justice was done. So it's
right.
Taken him all this to find out who did it.
And yeah.
That was the real goal all along.
Yeah, and you think that's sort of the end. I mean, it feels almost like a false ending a couple of times, but in the true Norrish fashion – Noirish?
Mm-hmm.
You get that great scene on the football field where he sort of, you know.
Where all great high school movies end.
Yeah,
Breakfast
true.
Club.
That's true. I didn't think about that.
That's great. Well, he, you know, Tug is, you know, and maybe the parlance is the button that Emily pushes to.
Right.
Or that Laura pushes to have Emily killed. You know, he did it, but she caused it.
Yeah, and that's sort of another tropey character is the easy to manipulate angry-tempered guy,
mm-hmm.
ill-tempered, because anyone can manipulate Tug. He's so easily manipulated in this movie by everybody.
Yeah, he's at the end of his own emotions.
Yeah, like
you
almost.
You get him mad, you get him sad, you get him
Yeah, you could tell him anything, and it could end with, she said what? Like, he would just believe whatever you tell him.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah man. She said you had no penis. She said what? He's that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's just looking for a reason to fight someone to prove anything.
That end is so great, though. I mean, this is on Netflix if you haven't seen it.
Well, it's a nice end, too, because
you should check it out.
It breaks from a lot of noir in the sense that ultimately the guilty people are punished. I mean, think about Chinatown. Like the harshest parts of that movie is that it ends with the woman, you know, Faye Dunaway, who's trying to protect her her daughter born of the incestuous relationship
Brutal.
Of her John Huston. She gets killed by accident. Yeah. And then the end is John Huston taking his granddaughter, who is his daughter / granddaughter, away.
It's just a gut punch.
Yeah. That's, you know, in the end, forget about it. It's Chinatown, you know?
Yeah. This movie at least has a satisfying ending because everyone goes down. I didn't want to see the Penn killed because I like that character.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It's hard to root against Lucas Haas.
Yeah. But he does. And Tug is ostensibly arrested. I mean, you don't hear that happen.
Yeah, I forget. Yeah. Well, I guess he gets arrested in the shootout or something like that. I mean, at that point,
when
Brendan runs away, the police are closing in.
Yeah. But it was her all along, though.
Yeah. It's a nice ending, too, because he doesn't do anything. She incriminates herself at the end. He simply gives his hunch that the brick, you know, if this is what I think is true, then you'll find the brick in her locker. And
yeah.
So
you know she's going down. But
how great is that? In high school, it's like the illegal drugs are in your locker on school grounds.
Yeah.
The safest place I could keep
That's
it was
true.
In a locker.
That's cool. And that great shot of the brick falling to the floor and like breaking apart. Mm-hmm. Because it had been cut. You know, that's what we learned too. That's why the guy was in a coma. Was because she had cut the drugs with I can't remember what chemical it was that Brain found.
This seems like such a problem with drugs. Why isn't there just a high quality alternative to cut your drugs with? Why don't they sell something like that in the head shops? That's full of like minerals and vitamins.
Yeah,
and,
right. It'll make you feel even better.
Yeah. Not only are you going to be high as AF, but you're going to be really regular.
Ruby said something AF the other day. I was like, oh boy, here we go. Another kind of Norrish thing is, you know, she's going down at the end, like legally, like the cops are going to get her. But sort of the worst punishment in this movie, though, is that he rejects her in the end. It's like that thing where they're like lip to lip almost.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, no, say it ain't so. And he's like, no, baby, like, that's it. I found you out.
Yeah.
And I'm out of here. And that's sort of the worst punishment in a movie like this.
Yeah. Well, he once again, he does the right thing. He somehow, fends off the wily charms of the femme fatale. And then I think they tied up right there at the end that the guy who chased him down and tried to kill him was hired by Brad. Like, that's the one thing that if they hadn't tied that up with the brain.
It was the one lingering little bit.
Yeah, that was the red herring they had to throw in there that they had to pay off with a little epilogue.
So it turns out. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Turns out it all did make sense.
Yeah, good movie though, man. So
kind of the equivalent to pulling the squid head off the old man Jones in the Scooby-Doo.
I was thinking about like why this movie works is because it was ballsy to try, and it so easily could have not worked, but like the acting is really good, and at the end of the day with these movies, you've got to have. And I looked up Ebert, and Ebert said the same thing. He was like, you've got to have a great story, and you got to do it right, or else the rest of it is just like a trick. Like, oh, it was set in high school. Get it? But fundamentally, though, at the root of this, as a really great detective yarn.
Yeah, your plot's got to hold together and it's got to stand up to multiple viewings, I think. If you find something, if you find a flaw, then
– Yeah.
And certainly in this day of social media, if there's a flaw, somebody's going to – chime in, and then everyone will know in advance, you know, or that will be the wrap of the movie.
Yeah. I may watch it again soonish because this is one of these that a close viewing after is pretty helpful.
Yeah. There's some other good ones. We Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is another another good one. The Cook, the Wife, the Gun and the Noodle Shop. I always massacre that title, but it's the Chinese take on a Blood
What about
Simple.
His wife and her lover? That's a different movie.
Is that the Gun and the Noodle Shop? Oh,
no,
terrible.
We should do that because I did Blood Simple already, and this is an Asian version, right?
Yeah, and the cinematography is beautiful. It's funny. It's so true to the like beat for beat. Very, I think it diverts a little bit, but it is also very. Very true to the original. And it's just fun. If you like Blood Simple, you'll love this. And
for sure. All right. Well, we'll figure it out. Maybe we'll also have to hit another. I've never seen The Maltese Falcon. Like, I want to cover one of these old school
classics.
That might
have to be a 3-episode journey.
Not really.
We'll definitely need a flow chart up on the wall for that one.
Is it pretty complex?
Yeah. It's like I said, I every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Right. This is a tough one. Yeah. All right, dude. Well, thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in on short notice. Sorry about bumping you a couple of weeks. Still friends?
Yeah, I guess.
Knives out? Knives out, pinky swear?
Pinky swear, absolutely. Right. Blood brothers.
All right, thanks, dude.
All right.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. For iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.